From the Art Center in downtown Carrboro, this is Claudio's Speakeasy and Radio Theater, a program that has fascinating guests, lively talk and conversation, community news, storytelling, and a look at our local entertainment scene. Good radio and always a few surprises. Claudio coming right up. Speakeasy and Radio Theater, heard at 103.5 FM, Community Radio, WCOM. Now here's Claudio.
Good morning, one and all, and thank you for tuning us in once again on the Speakeasy. This morning I have the pleasure of introducing Dottore Hatzi Nitoli. That's Dr. Hatzi Nitoli. And she is going to take us through a journey that involves her own life greatly in the field of education, as well as poetry, Spanish poetry, all the way up to the Baroque era. So there's going to be all kinds of things to explore. I'm pretty much regarding her as a tutor I've brought in to get an education myself, and you folks can just eavesdrop and catch the act. Good morning.
Good morning, Claudio.
It's a real pleasure to have you. Someone that says my name right. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes.
Well, welcome to the Speakeasy.
Thank you very much.
I know that you had asked me earlier to begin with one of my... The watch just fell down. Are we having a Salvador Dali moment here? you'd asked me to begin with one of my own poems, and your reason for... You explained. I like that reason.
One of the things that I would like for us to see today is the evolution and the devolution of poetry, because leading up to the Barroco, which is our major focus today, it's very, very studied and formalized. And then, beginning of the 19th century, things kind of just sort of fell apart, and it's like a wave. Think of a wave cresting and then hitting the shore and just kind of anything goes. Mm-hmm. And your poetry, the piece that you have is that we decided on, it would be called Poesía Vulgar, which doesn't mean dirty poetry. That would be something totally different. It is of the people, and I believe we have almost a sea shanty of your own composition, right?
Pretty much so, from a collection, a book I wrote, which I actually perform on stage, called Seafarers, Chronicles of the Suspense and Romance of the Seas. I give you No Man's Land. It is said that the sea is the devil's domain, where angels move only in silent refrain, where the waters may leap like a demon on high, and the visions about are a seed in the eye. With her bounty of sorrows stored fathoms below, by the skulls of her tempters that roll in her tow, this no man's land, this pirate's abode, that tugs at the sinews of her every load. I bid you, if only you dare, to lend me your vision, these visions to share, of sun, moon, of shadow, and the lure of the sea, of all that is kindred to the soul that is me.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely.
Thank you.
If you don't listen to the words, you had da 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 da. Da 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 da.
And somebody was dozing off, right?
No. It's a very easy rhythm. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not an expert in English, Anglo-Saxon poetry. My specialty is romance, which is Spanish, Portuguese, Italian.
Which is my greatest influence.
Right. But what you just did was you rendered into what is extremely ancient, and that is we learned in the beginning of us as sentient beings to remember things through poetry. Poetry is the oldest genre.
I believe it.
And if you understand why, it's because we weren't writing. And so what did we have to do? Well, we had to figure out a way to give our offspring, our descendants, a way to remember our history, our past. And the easiest way to do that is with rhyme and meter.
And pentameter, however one...
Meter. And what you have, and if you look at traditional cultures still to this day, that's how lessons are taught, is in poetry. Now, we who are so technologically advanced, we particularly don't like poetry, but I will tell you that I've had students just burst into tears in my classes, a couple of them, not many, one or two of them did. Mm-hmm. But even the most stolidly, I hate poetry, would bend a little when they realized, oh my gosh, this is so ancient, this is our core and our center. The Bible was written it was metered.
It has a very poetic quality.
It was metered when it was translated. Of course, it lost that. But there came a time when the Roman Empire fell apart, because basically what we have in our Western culture is a reworking of the Greco-Roman standards. And that's the Renaissance, the whole thing. And what we're going to look at today, particularly in Spanish, is where the Barroco, first of all, let me go back a little and give you some time. The Barroco is like every other period. There's no line in the sand that says that's Renaissance, that's Barroco. It was an evolution. It was a change. In the medieval period, after the Roman Empire fell apart, the church took over because there needed to be something. Mm-hmm. And their poetry was all pretty much religious. And they had a studied format, and it was their Latin, but it really wasn't the Latin of the Romans, because the Romans, you know, had two Latins. They had what the ordinary people spoke, the mm-hmm. vulgo, and then there was the classical, which is what the erudite wrote, the people who were erudite wrote in. Well, supposedly we lost all that. Actually, we didn't. But the church, because of different things, the church managed to maintain something of what had been the Roman Empire. And we see that in their poetry, but it's didactic. It's teaching. Now, some of the most beautiful poetry I ever read in Spanish was medieval Spanish poetry, and it was the Milagros de Nuestra Señora la Virgen María, which is Miracles of the Virgin. These were didactic stories, but they were in poetic form mm-hmm. because this could be taught to the people, and they could remember it, because it had that song.
That la-di-da element, yes.
Yeah, it was in there. Well, then everybody got all excited. They said, oh, Italy has rediscovered. Actually, Italy didn't rediscover anything. They just did buy some texts. But the Roman tradition didn't die out, because if you remember your history, Spain was... it was three cultures. All kinds of things happened. There were all kinds of warfare, and I won't go into that. But there were basically three cultures that existed in Spain. There was the Musulmana, brought in by the Moors in 744, I think. The Cristiano, which never went away. And the Judío, which was there before the Roman fall because mm-hmm. of the diaspora. So there were several Visigothic kings who were very interesting, because on the one hand, they were romping and stomping and beating up on each other. On the other hand, they were very interesting. They were not illiterate. And one of them, Alfonso el Sabio in Toledo, developed what was called el Colegio de Traductores. which was a college of translators. He brought in the best thinkers of the Christian community, the Jewish community, and the Islamic community.
Boy, there's a combination.
And he had, first of all, his first tome was the history of the world.
There we go.
But he managed to keep alive and to promote erudition, secular erudition, which is not church. No, but still there was a didactic form there. When the Renaissance really broke out in all of Europe, there was a gusto for life. There was a return to what the Greco-Roman ethic was all about. And so this idea of living to die, which was the medieval attitude, we suffer here so we can live eternally once we're dead, it really didn't sit well. You know, it's like why can't we have fun now? So they went back to rereading the classics, i.e. the Romans and the Greeks. And everything for a while, it was extremely measured and studied. Now, what I mean by that is precisely that. If you were going to be educated, you are going to be educated. They're poetics, the Poetica. If you ever see a book that's got the word Poetica, it means it's a list of rules. Now, if you look at the Princeton Poetics, the last time I bought a Princeton Poetics was just before the technological explosion, and it was, I believe I looked at it the other day, it was 1,500 pages long.
Goodness.
Which is nothing compared to the Poetica. Before the Poetica was printed, and I believe the printing press, I'm not really for sure, you might know this, Claudio, when was the Gutenberg Bible, like 1450, 60?
That rings a bell, but I'm afraid I'm hard-pressed
well,
to remember.
I'm not good with numbers, but I'm pretty sure it was around then because Gutenberg died in 1460, give or take a few years, so I'm going to say 1450s. Once that happened, well, my goodness, books, the publishing of books just exploded, so the Poetica could be turned out en masse, and there were schools all over the place, and they were teaching poetry, poetics. And I know this isn't television, I wish it were, because when we get into this, I want to show you just exactly how studied the creation of poetry is, was. Now, the Barocco, they were the hippies and the bohemians. Went against the rule, except they really didn't. They just, I have often read that the period, the Renaissance period, which is the early, and here again, we have to, if we're going to talk dates, we can't say this is when the Renaissance ended and the Barocco began, because there was like this, again, think of your waves. There's this just
overlapping
movement, you know. Some people were staying very formalized. You think of them as gardens. The Renaissance was had beautiful lines, which was a misconception, because if we think about the Greeks, don't you know those beautiful marble statues? They were actually painted. They were painted, for goodness sakes, in garish colors. You know, we think of it as this pristine white marble, beautiful, gorgeous. But anyway. So the Renaissance had this sensibility of, you know, geometric lines, straight, and pathways that would go down the sides of reflecting pools and beautiful buildings. Well, the Barocco is referred to the garden that went wild. If you're a gardener like I am, I hate cutting, thinning, pruning. I just let things just go crazy.
That's my garden, yes.
Yeah, so there you are. You're in the Barocco, but you're still immersed in knowing formulae and in knowing how to arrange words. There's like, and the two poets that I thought maybe we could focus on today are Luis de Góngora, who is the beginning of the Barocco, more or less, in Spain, and Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, who was born in Mexico, but she was still Spanish, because when she died, it was very much Spain. They just they called themselves Nueva España, you know. So it was just like long way over there to get to Mexico City, but they still thought of it as Spain.
Well, before we go there, I'd like to impose for a moment and just tell the world a little bit about who Hatsi Nitoli is.
Oh, well, I'm...
So that we'll qualify you to the
audience.
I am
a purveyor of information. I am a...
An educator for most of your life.
I am a... born-again college student over and over. I taught. I'm pretty Barroco myself because I was often accused of secular humanism, which was a big deal in the Barroco, was the human aspect, as you'll see in one of these poems, as my students will say, way cool. Or they used to. They don't say that anymore. But anyway, I taught high school for 17 years. I went back to graduate school when I was 38. I put the last dot on my dissertation when I was 49 and three quarters, and I marched when I was 50. Mm. And then I taught. I actually taught at the university level for 25 years, because the whole time that I was doing my graduate studies, I was teaching here. And I've taught on... Well, it depends upon where you study. I don't know. South Americans say that North and South America are one continent. We say, nope, we're two continents. So I've either taught on two or three continents, whichever. You know.
And your primary theme being arts?
I always taught Spanish to begin with, because it was easy. I can't add and subtract, but I can speak languages. So I went back... with the intention of learning, I was truly Renaissance. I wanted to know everything. I even wanted to learn Arabic. Well, I didn't have the time to do that. But I did Italian and Portuguese and Catalan. Hmm. French, I'm sorry, I can read it. I just, if you're going to swallow three quarters of the word and not say it, why bother? You know. So
it's kitchen French with me, because I apprentice in Germany. So.
I know. But
Claudio,
that's...
I'd like to ask Dr. Nitoli something.
Please.
Dr. Nitoli, I've read that you've taught in Bolivia and in Spain overseas, and of course here at UNC in Chapel Hill. What difference would you say there would be in the students, American students, here at Chapel Hill or at Meredith in Raleigh? I understand you taught there. And compared to, say, the students in Bolivia or in Spain, Spanish students,
well,
South American
culture,
students.
The Hispanic culture, the Mediterranean, let's say the Latin, because Latin encompasses everything that is Italian, Portuguese, Catalan, Spanish, even to a little degree North Africa. The attitude is very different than it is in this country. We're way practical. But remember, this country was settled by Puritans. Work, reproduce, and die.
Yeah, pretty much.
And not a whole lot of fun in the reproduction. That was just a necessity. The Mediterranean culture is much more interested in the arts. My favorite example, I love Pisa. I absolutely love Pisa. But I have never seen anybody get off of a bus and look at the Leaning Tower that they didn't laugh. Because here's this gorgeous, beautiful architectural gem, and nobody went and looked underneath to see what they were building it on. You know, the engineering part, we would have gone in there, we would have dug it, but then we would have built this square box thing. You know, we wouldn't have made it pretty. Basically, that's the difference. And the students here, and I'm speaking from my experience, not every student, don't have the advantage of being exposed to the arts. We have a governor right now who has publicly stated that he doesn't think a liberal arts degree, from which he came, by the by, is worth anything.
Interesting.
So, it's not in our culture to appreciate. I mean, if you're an artist in this country, you have to work very, very hard. And when I say art, I mean music, poetry, literature,
theater, dance.
We're excellent. But we don't value it. We don't put the money into it. Let me tell you, Bolivia has a Ballet Folklorico Nacional.
Oh, yes. We've had actually some of the members of that at the Carolina Theater.
They are the second poorest economy in this hemisphere after Haiti, but they have a Ballet Folklorico Nacional. They have an art gallery on every corner in Cochabamba. Now,
very soulful people as well, and I think that's why they keep their spirits alive by supporting these things.
There's the Spanish influence there, but also there's the indigenous influence, mm-hmm. enormous indigenous influence. I don't know where we lost our souls. I'm not going to say we lost our souls. We just got really wound up in the practical.
Diluted in commercialism.
I reckon.
That's one of my guesses, just from and I'm also swimming in it myself.
Occasionally you will hear a Southernism fall in because I grew up in eastern North Carolina. Uh-huh. So when my father was
so
here.
So where's home originally?
The world, because my father was military, and uh-huh. my earliest memories are crossing the Pacific when I was three.
Hmm.
So I'm well-traveled. I've always been exposed to languages. And I love the arts.
So you're the perfect vessel to be conveying this moment.
Well, I'm pretty well educated, too. Let me tell you.
No doubt.
12 years I spent at the graduate level because I liked it. And I was able to keep body and soul together at the time. I'm not rich, not by a long shot, but I bet I have a better education than 3/4 of the population in this town.
I can believe
which
that.
Is an amazing population, because I think we have more per capita PhDs than
probably so.
You know, anywhere else. So, shall we get back to poetry?
Yes, we shall. Oh, before we do that, did you just retire, or what's the story on that, or are you about to retire?
No, I did. Okay. Mm-hmm. Every 50 years, this country goes through. We need practical education so we can get our kids out there selling cars and shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Teach them just enough language so they can go out and sell
commercialism, like I said.
Well, yeah, I don't have another 50 years, frankly. I came in at the end of one of those cycles. I managed to get a dynamite education from some incredible professors. And now the pendulum has swung back to we need to be practical. And to be quite honest with you, I don't care if I never teach a beginning class of any language ever again. Did it for 47 years. Actually, I started 50 years ago because I can't remember what it was called. It was some kind of tutoring service in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it in foreign languages. And I don't really care if you put an accent in the right place or not anymore. I'm done with that. So about 50 years, and I figured it was time. And plus, if they changed the computer program one more time, I was going to just go scream. So,
well, they just changed the computer here at WCOM and turned me into spam, so yeah. I can relate.
Okay.
Oh, goodness. So now, what does retirement entail for you? Are you still going to be involved on some level? Of course, I'm going to have you back on radio, so that's a given.
Well, what am I doing in retirement? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm doing in retirement? I'm having a cup of coffee till about 10 o'clock.
Hey, I like that. And I did that long before, and I'm not retired yet. I still do that.
Well, I never did that. And I've discovered that I'm a little, excuse my humor here, I'm CDO.
That's we don't excuse humor here.
Okay.
We insist on it.
CDO, that is OCD, but the letter's in the right order now.
CDO, please explain, Lucy.
So, no, if OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm CDO, because now the letters are in the right order.
Oh,
CD.
I see. Okay.
But I have discovered that I'm a little bit that way, because what I've done is I've taken about 30 years' worth of clippings of recipes, and I have organized them in my fashion.
Hmm.
As my spouse will tell you, I've got this huge notebook that is too small. I have organized. That's what I've been pretty much doing until you said do something. And then I went back to this and I thought, oh, God, I do so love this poetry. You know, I really love teaching poetry. I don't know. I'm going to have to do something.
Oh, I can tell you I have a passion for this, which is my reason for asking.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, we could do, oh, my goodness, there's so much we could do like this.
Well, I can't afford a professor, but I can afford to have you on the show, so you're coming back.
The Vanguardia in Latin America is a fabulous period to see. Oh, there's a poem in that I'd have to read you and tell you a story about that.
Please
but anyway,
do.
So where shall we go for now?
So we shall switch back to where you were before.
Okay. All right. So we've already established that that poetry was, well, all right, let me just say this. The Greeks, the first things the Greeks ever produced were long saga is a Scandinavian word, and epic poems. Now, pardon me, but I've taught all this in one language, and so I get a little bit lost when I'm not a good translator. I'm an interpreter, but I can't translate because I stay in one language or the other. So.
And some things don't translate easily either.
Right. Well, epico is myself, pretty, right. You know, but I get lost in there somewhere. So anyway, think of it, the Odyssey and the Iliad, or the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Oh, yes.
That's, you know, that's probably the oldest thing. One of the oldest things we have in Western.
And still a formula in even modern-day movies.
Exactly.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou, for example.
And let me tell you a little story about that. I taught high school in Eastern North Carolina, and when I was teaching, we didn't have, you know, we didn't know how to teach people to read. And I had a class of 20-some-odd freshman boys ranging from 13 to 20 because they couldn't read, so they couldn't pass. So how am I going to teach them the Iliad and the Odyssey? So what I did was I read it to them, and I had them interpret it, and I had them act it out. And about 20 years after that, I happened to be back in Washington, is where I was teaching in Chocowinie. This hirsute individual, he could have been a pirate. He could have been an English pirate. There was hair all over. And I could just see his blue eyes and his pink nose, and that was about it. And he said, "Are you Ms. Natoli?" I said, "I am, in fact." And he said, I know what them Greeks meant by the rosy-fingered dawn. And it dawned. This was one of my students that I couldn't teach to read, but I could teach him. He became a fisherman, so of course he knew what the rosy-fingered dawn was. And it gives me chills to think about it now that I actually helped somebody connect with something that's very ancient.
It's got to be. Well, ultimately, that's your reward.
Really?
Yeah.
He didn't say thank you. He didn't say, but I knew that was a thank you.
No doubt.
You know, I'm sitting here right now, and
I'm sure there's been more than one of those situations.
Perhaps. Anyway, so that's my own personal thing. So let's look at the Barroco. All right, I mentioned that they had poeticas, you know, books on formulae. And I know it's not television, but I want you to just take a look at this. These are the last two lines in strophe 1, 2, and 4 of one of the poems by Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. And what she has done here is she has taken words, it's called a retuécano, which means you take the same word, and by changing its position syntactically, you change the meaning of the word.
I can see that, yes.
You know, and it's an entirely, this is what she's talking about, the vanities of life. She was probably bordering on an ascetic. She was quite different from her mentor, who was Luis de Góngora. But as you can see from the language, and I have to turn this
it's
around.
It's all in Spanish, please do. And the page I'm looking at is basically just a graphic design of the layout
exactly.
That Hatzi is describing.
What that is it's called an analysis semántico. It's looking at the language only by itself. So she says, poner bellezas en mi entendimiento y no mi entendimiento en las bellezas. Poner riquezas en mi entendimiento, que no mi entendimiento en las riquezas. Consumir vanidades de la vida, que consumir la vida en vanidades. All three of those are saying, basically, better to put into my mind beauty than my mind into beauty. In other words, better that I learn rather than focus on the material. And in the end, the same thing. I mean, all three of them, they keep repeating. Basically, she's saying it's far better to learn than it is to look for wealth, to look for beauty, to look for the vanities of life, because these are all fleeting and they die. She doesn't actually say that, but that's the intention there. So but you can see graphically the first part, the first verso, the first line is always a verb followed by a noun, followed by another noun, and then the second one is a consonantal phrase, and it's always the same, pretty much. So it it varies a little bit in the end, but you follow the same pattern. Now that's studied, but she takes the same word and turns it around to mean something entirely different in the second line than in the first one. That's an example of what the Barocco was all about. And every single time they wrote a poem, they had to do something like that. And that's only one thing.
Right, I'm sure.
Now, what's his name? Góngora was earlier. Let me give you a little background on these two. They're both church people.
Okay.
But, so oh, my God, are they different.
Very secular than in their work.
Totally. Well, they were they were clerical. She was a nun. He was a priest.
Mm.
They were in I'm just being distracted by the building going on across
There's
the way.
There's all sorts of harmonies coming through those bricks, yes.
Anyway, it was a little shocking. Sor Juana was many things that just gave her no future in life. She was illegitimate. She was born of a Spanish military individual and the daughter of a minor political entity in Mexico. But
so it was a matter of class, and she went to the cloisters.
Right. She was a woman and probably a lesbian. So what were her choices?
Tough times.
Yeah.
Boy.
She couldn't prostitute herself. She couldn't be a lawyer. So she chose the church. Góngora was the second or third son of a Cordobés, of an Hidalgo, an hijo de algo, a son of something, which is a minor aristocracy, so they had something. And he couldn't inherit anything. So what was he going to do? Well, he liked gambling. He liked women. He liked good wine. He was not going to go out and fight. So his choices were military or church. So he wound up in the church. He became a priest. Well, he didn't like the court. He thought they were just too presumptuous and too phony and too fakey. And guess what? He wound up as the confessor for, I don't know, one of the Carlos somebody or other. But both of them were incredible masters of their art. They were both extremely studied. She was self-taught, autodidactica. Mm-hmm. He was educated. He started, and frankly, I think she ended the Barocco ahead of where he did. She called him her master, and she learned beautifully from him.
Hmm.
He was not the only Barocco poet that stood out, but he was like Papa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was like the daddy. There were others who came along in the same tone of poetic expression. And they were always fighting amongst themselves. They would write horrible invectives about each other, but measured.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Down to the
precision
last
was there.
Syllable. down to the last syllable. May I read you a sonnet from
Please.
Each one?
I'd
All right. It. So, Luis.
Are you going to do it in Spanish and then give us the English translation?
I'll do it in Spanish and then I'll hit the high points, the gist of the matter. Because
right.
What I want you to hear is I was trying this on my spouse this morning. I said, can you hear the music? Can you hear the measure? Can you hear the rhyme? Can you hear the meter? And he said, yes, because he doesn't know anything about Barocco Spanish poetry, let alone Spanish. Yeah, I can hear it. So.
Well then.
Anyway.
Now, speaking of music, did you have any more music you wanted us to play in the
interim? Yes, I actually, let me say one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very interesting the way everything started, because you had a piece of, what would you call that, Rocco? What would you call the very beginning, the jamming piece?
Jazz?
An intro.
No. What genre? Was that jazz or was that rock?
That was acoustic jazz.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you had acoustic jazz, and then the piece that I asked you to play is early Barocco. There's something of a difference there. And this piece that, it's John Williams, by the way, whom I think
interesting.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
Been
guitarist.
Around a long time, too.
This is by Gaspar Sanz, who, this particular piece, he published in 1674. So it's a little bit older, but it gives you and let me just tell you one thing about the first piece we came in with. I love this. This is so Barocco. This was Alonso Mudarra's Fantasia, which was printed in about 1546 in the manner of Ludovico. But he says, in English, they quoted him as saying, "The work is full of hard, shocking dissonances, Barocco." The composer explains one passage with the words, "From here until nearly to the end, there are some wrong notes, but if you play them well, they won't sound so bad." Barocco. It's like in your eye. The piece that you're going to listen to right now is a little more refined. It's towards the end of the period, but what you're not going to hear is a repetition of motif. It's different. It doesn't keep repeating the same thing.
So we're going to go to a little bit of music, and then we're going to come back to Hatsy with great poetry.
Listening to Claudio Speakeasy in Radio Theater. This is WCOM, made possible by our underwriters, contributors, and volunteers. Support us. Donations are always welcomed. We're your voice in our community. Now back to Claudio.
And that selection was provided us by Dottora Hatsy Nitoli, who is going to continue on with the Spanish poetry all the way into the Baroque era. I want to very quickly acknowledge my underwriter, and that is the Apex Arts Council. Anything you want to find out about them, just go to their website. You can find it by clicking Apex Arts Council. Back to you, Hatsy.
Thank you. All right, so the two poets that we're looking at are the Alpha and the Omega of the Barocco period itself. One began, Luis de Góngora, as we've already said, this womanizing, gambling, really digging wine. He loved wine. He was a Cordobés, and the Cordobeses have some seriously good wine.
no doubt.
And Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, who ended it in a Mexican convent. Actually, the saddest part of her story is that the church hierarchy, well, of course, they were threatened by this was a woman, for God's sakes, yes, who actually understood science. Which was
fancy that.
Totally
yeah.
Verboten, you know. Yeah.
Right.
You know, she was a scientist. She did experiments. She was a precursor of this of the scientific method. She would do things. They forbade her to write, and so she was obedient. She did what she did. Agree with her vows. Anyway. So that being said,
what a pity.
Truly. Now in Góngora, both of these are sonnets. The sonnet came out of Sicily. Even the Italians aren't too happy about that fact. They say, oh, and I forget his name. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I haven't done this for a while, so I've forgotten his name.
You're forgiven.
Petrarca. That's right. Petrarca was like the father of the sonnet. No, he wasn't. He spent some time in Sicily where the Siciliani were doing sonnets, you know, like forever.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because there was always something going back and forth between Spain. Spain actually had its court in Naples. I forget how many. It was about 100 years. And they there was a connection between Felipe, the consort of Isabella Católica, and the seat of Sicily. So there's been a connection between Spain and especially southern Italy. One of the things when you go to southern Italy is, as you probably well know, nobody speaks Italian in Italy. They speak whatever happens to be the village, right, or the town, the up top of the mountain, one language, bottom of the mountain, totally other. But in, for example, in Spanish, the verb tener is to have, possess. And in Naples and Sicilia, it's tenere.
Tenere.
Which up north, it's avere. Totally different language. Avere in Spanish, haber, is only an auxiliary verb that's used as like have, eaten.
Can that, in a sense, be attributed to dialects?
Oh, absolutely. Truly.
Yeah.
Truly. So anyway, all right, so Luis de Góngora, and I had to write this down because they always put it in Roman numerals, always. So it's 166, 166, in which you can hear his hedonism, his sensuality, but you also get a sense of, carpe diem. Because tempus fugit.
Seize the day, yes.
Enjoy the day, because time flies. So, and of course, this is directed to a beautiful woman. Always is.
Totally understood. That's where I directed most of mine.
So that's always the way it is, usually. But it's the last line of the last verse that both of these poets use. So let me read Luis de Góngora. Mientras por competir con tu cabello, oro bruñido al sol relumbre en vano, mientras con menosprecio en medio el llano mira tu blanca frente el lilio bello, mientras a cada labio por cogello siguen más ojos que al clavel temprano, y mientras triunfa con desdén lo sano del luciente cristal y tu gentil cuello, goza cuello, cabello, labio y frente antes que lo que fue en tu edad dorada, oro, lilio, clavel, cristal, luciente. No solo en plata o viola troncada se vuelve, mas tú y ello juntamente en tierra, en humo, en polvo, en sombra, en nada.
Ooh. And there's music in the language alone.
Absolutely. If you don't even understand it,
it's beautiful,
hear
yeah.
it. Every syllable is measured because that's how you did it.
Mm-hmm.
The rima, the rhyme is exactly, it's a plan. We don't have time, but everything has a name. Everything has a name. This is a sonnet, by the way. All right, so.
In the truest sense, yes.
Right. And then in later years, almost 100 years later, Sor Juana wrote, okay, so basically what Luis de Góngora is saying here is literally, you got pretty hair, you got a beautiful forehead. Oh, man, your lips are amazing, and your throat is like shining crystal. You know, he's just one of my girl students one time told me, boy, if somebody write me a poem like that, I'd do anything he wanted.
Like, ooh, baby.
Right. But then he goes back, and he compares her to, well, he compares all of her aspects to first of all, the most valuable, in Spanish period, mineral was gold. But he kind of bookends her beauty between two minerals, and in the middle, everything's compared to quite beautiful flowers. And then his last estrofa, his last, in English, what is verse, says, but, you know, the cut, the viola, which is violet, the violet cut, and it's not going to become silver, but you and it, meaning the violet, together are going to be, and he doesn't say are going to be, he just says, mas tú y ello juntamente en tierra, in dirt, in smoke, in dust, in shadow, in nothing, i.e., tempest fugit, baby, enjoy your beauty.
Right.
You know, carpe those días, diems. Now, Sor Juana took another avenue. Her thing was honesty. Someone had given her a portrait, quite a beautiful portrait, actually, and probably very realistic. But what it did was it did the 16th century version of airbrushing.
And was this portrait of herself?
Yes, okay. Yes. Someone had painted her. Because she was very popular in Mexico. Mm-hmm. She was one of the favorites of the Virreina and the viceroys, the king's representatives over there. And they really wanted her to stay in the court. But she said, nope, you'll have to marry me off to somebody, and there's nothing worse than getting married.
Oh, no.
You know, which meant no more studying, probably having multiple children and dying, because that was the major cause of death. For women at that time. So what she's doing here is complaining about how hypocritical this painting is, because it takes away all of the horrors of aging, and it's an artifice. It's a vain artifice. It's a delicate flower. I've told you.
Flora, flower, yes.
Yeah, she's a delicate flower. But it's totally useless. It's just a vain, erring, I have no idea how to say diligencia in English. It's all of these things that, well, Hollywood.
Mm. Yes, you know? There we go. That summarizes it.
It's her last verso, her last line that really goes back to whom she called her maestro. It's the same thing you'll hear.
And essentially she was not impressed.
No, but she uses the same tempus fugit, or fugit if you prefer, the same thing to make her lesson. She says, este que ves engaño colorido, que del arte ostentando los primores con falsos silogismos de colores, es cauteloso engaño del sentido, este en quien la lisona de aprendido excusar de los años de horrores y venciendo del tiempo los rigores, triunfar de la vejez y del olvido, es un vano artificio del cuidado, es una flor al viento delicada, es un resguardo inútil para el hado, es una necia diligencia errada, es un afán caduco y bien mirado, es cadáver, es polvo, es sombra, es nada. So,
and I'll have mine with French fried potatoes.
So she has done exactly the same thing as her mentor, but instead of saying, gather ye flowers while ye may, she's saying, this whole thing, this whole vain attitude we have, it's nothing, because this is where it ends. In corpse, in dust, in a shadow, in nothing. So it's like, yeah, boy.
So paint me something haunting, will you?
Yes. He, however, really wanted to go out there and and carpe his diems.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Thank you. So that, in a nutshell, very, very brief nutshell, is the Barroco. It's very much oriented towards the human aspect of life.
Now, would you say that was, when you refer to it as the Baroque mm-hmm. era, would you say that was limited, or that that's actually still going on, I would think?
Well, see, that's the thing about Spain and much of the rest of the Hispanic experience in the world is, yeah, nothing ever ended. Mm-hmm. It's still right. There, all of it. It's just that it morphed. You can look at some writing. I love some Spanish novelists in the 20th century. And one of the things you have to remember is we're talking about cultures that have had to survive terrible repression. Franco was probably the filthiest of all the fascist monsters, mm-hmm. because he invited outsiders to come in and kill his own people. And he didn't have the... He didn't have the cojones to go out and do it himself, you know? He invited the Germans in to bomb the Basque because they wouldn't cotton to him. And the Catalans, he forbade them to speak their own language. He was not a good guy.
There are quite a few cultures that have that.
Exactly.
Guilt. Yes.
But these authors about whom I'm speaking were writing probably all of the literature in Latin America and Spain in different times had to hide the truth. So they were writing subversive literature.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing it with words. And that's another whole story.
Well, the poets were also considered revolutionaries at one time.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
But the thing of it is, if you look at these novelists, one of their sentences goes on for 2.5 pages. One sentence.
Hi.
That is Barroco.
Okay.
You know, that is totally Barroco. Go look at a church built in the 16th century anywhere in Latin America and in Spain, and my goodness, it's a flower garden gone to sea. You know, it's just like a junk. It's amazing. But there is studied formula there.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
It's not like Rocco, who was the artist that we were talking about that just threw paint?
Oh, Jackson Pollock?
Jackson Pollock.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like...
Abstract. Mm-hmm.
There was a formula here. It was amazingly...
I think his formula was a hangover.
Yeah. It probably...
Well, it seems everything was so much more structured earlier
yeah.
on.
Yes.
And now, in the abstract, you can pretty much get away with anything you want in the
mm-hmm.
arts.
That's
and
true.
Call it art.
When you realize that these were people who could... because of their social class, could only wear certain colors. And certain colors were forbidden them because they were not in the right social class.
Uh-huh.
Now,
okay.
That's pretty well structured.
Yeah, I would say.
You know, and so even though the Barroco was, as I say, they were the Bohemians. Well, and if we think about the Bohemians, Ginsberg, would you call him?
I would say so, definitely.
Okay, Ginsberg had a certain studied way of expressing himself that rap singers don't, and rap is poetry.
Oh, absolutely!
But it's
all poetry. Literature.
It's poetry. But then I would say that rap is the poesía vulgar, because these are just kids with mm-hmm. ideas that are very talented, make it rhyme, but a metaphor. I don't think they know what a metaphor is. I don't think they'd know what a topos is. And these were formulas that...
And they may be perfect at expressing these, but have no idea what it actually
exactly,
is.
Exactly. You had a couple of metaphors in your poem,
mm-hmm.
But you weren't studied at doing that, whereas
no.
the metaphors that these people would do was studied.
Yes.
It was intentional. And so we just, as I say, we devolved out of that. We evolved, but yes, the Barroco still is alive and well.
Yeah,
it's just
different. Because I myself am very influenced by the classics. I might as well have been mm-hmm. alive 100 years ago the way I write. I enjoy writing in a classical style.
Oh, yeah,
style.
But that's modern. That's not classic.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I'm modern.
When one says classic, one is talking about the Romans and the Greeks.
Mm. Okay.
And the modern period, believe it or not, the modern period began in the 15th century, late 15th century.
Well, I stand corrected. I'd be here now.
We're actually postmodern.
Good. Gotcha. But I know that on many occasions when I perform Seafarers or perform my storytelling, it all has that feel to it. The classics is very quickly pointed out by reviewers or critics.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always just sort of assumed that, but it's wonderful to be a little further educated to realize that.
Well,
I'm actually here now. Good.
Yes, you are. But the thing of it is
I'll be fodder tomorrow.
We don't use our language as it should be. I mean, what is sequestered funds?
Yeah, I don't even know.
I mean, sequestering, what does anything mean anymore?
I think that politicians love to throw big words around so that the average person doesn't have a clue and just thinks it's something very sophisticated that they've managed to put together through a lot of hard work.
I think the military have developed. I think the military, American military, was probably the beginning of this. I mean, what is an entrenching tool? Darn it, it's a shovel.
Thank you, yes.
You know? So we have corrupted our language and we have changed it. It's an evolution.
Sad but true.
It's an evolution. So it's the same thing when the church said, oh, no, we still speak Latin. No, they didn't. They did not speak Latin. They spoke this kind of intermediate. What they spoke was Romance.
Mm-hmm. I know they occasionally still have Latin masses and so on.
Right, but that was not Roman Latin. I don't care how much they protest that it is, it's not.
Mm.
And why do you think Latin is a dead language? It was hard.
No doubt.
It was difficult. you couldn't deal with Latin. That's why the Vulgo, all of these Vulgate languages, broke up, because it was a whole lot easier.
I can believe it.
I know. Have you studied Latin?
To a limited degree.
It was hard, wasn't it?
I was a Catholic, but I denounced that many moons ago.
Well, but Catholicism never really taught Latin. They taught church.
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly. I was pretty much bored with what I was given to study. It didn't really make sense to me either, and it made no sense to me at all why we should be speaking this language when nobody in church is going to understand it.
Well, that's when I left the church, is when they did away with the Latin, because I hadn't really figured out what they were saying. And when it was Latin, I was like, I could make it anything I wanted.
Oh, exactly.
It to be,
yes,
you know?
Yes, yes.
And let me tell you,
they actually had the advantage.
Right. There's nothing better for a 6-year-old than, you know, lace veils and mm-hmm. candles and statues
oh, the
and incense
costumery
and
is
gold.
Fantastic.
And,
yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's another story.
Indeed. For another time. And I want to wish you absolutely splendid things in your retirement.
Thank
and
you.
Please plan on being on again.
Thank you.
I'd like to pick certain themes with you and do more productions like this.
Okay, it's really
been
my pleasure.
Pleasure having you on, ladies and gentlemen. You've been listening to Dottora Hatzi Nitoli educating us on the Spanish poetry, her own life to some degree. I would say you were rather humble with that gesture, but we'll find out more about you in the future. Rocco, I want to thank you for being the wonderful co-host that you are, and everyone for tuning in. Tune us in next time. Our motto here is, you keep us tuned in, and we'll keep you turned on. Cheers.